I am a health scientist in the Division of Human Development and Disability, which is in the National Center for Birth Defects and Developmental Disabilities at the CDC. I've been there since 2008 and primarily look at kind of health risk behaviors among persons with disability, adults with disabilities. So I'm going to be speaking this morning about some preliminary work we're doing looking at mammography prevalence by disability type using 2005 and 2008 data from the National Health Interview Survey. I have nothing to disclose. And I'd like to first just take a quick moment to acknowledge my collaborators, Alyssa Cyrus and Brian Armour, who are colleagues in the division, and Jackie Miller and Brunella Framartino, who are with the Division of Cancer Prevention and Control at CDC. Just a brief background, which is probably familiar to most people. We know breast cancer is a leading cause of cancer-related death among women, and mammography has really been found to be a key method of screening and early detection. And there's a number of groups, including ones I have listed here, the National Cancer Institute, American Cancer Society, and the American College of Radiology, who recommend that women 40 and older receive at least a mammogram every other year. We've done, I think most people are familiar with, when the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force released some updated age recommendations late last year. We did sort of a sensitivity analysis and just compared, our analysis is focusing on women 40 and older, but just as a comparison, we also looked at women 50 to 74 just to see if there were any differences among women with a disability and what we found. And I'm going to briefly mention those. So as far as disability, there's a number of estimates in terms of prevalence of disability, but there are estimates that show that as many as 30% of women may have a disability or some type of a limitation. We do know that women with a disability are really at least at a similar risk of breast cancer as women without a disability. And just in other work that's been done, we know that in general, women with a disability overall tend to be less likely than women without a disability to obtain a mammogram within a typically a two-year time frame. So I'd like to spend a moment just talking to you about kind of how we're defining disability and how we're considering disability for this analysis. The concept of disability is really one where we see a person's activity level may be limited because of an interaction between their health and environment, so maybe some environmental restrictions. Disability, however, is not equivalent to poor health. Right now, there are over 60 federal definitions of disability. However, a number of them are focused on work-related disability, but the one we've chosen to use we feel is more of an inclusive definition and really one that can help us answer some public health questions. We also know sort of the type of disability can present unique challenges for the person. For example, somebody with a movement or mobility limitation may have difficulty with physical barriers in the environment versus somebody who is deaf or has hearing difficulty may have difficulty accessing health education materials. So the questions that we were hoping to answer with this analysis is, what is the reported prevalence of mammography by disability type, and are there really differences between them? We also wanted to know further on, what is the association between disability type and mammography once we control for sociodemographic variables, and do any differences continue to persist? So like I mentioned previously, the data we used were from the 2005 and the 2008 National Health Interview Survey, which were the two most previous years that a cancer supplement was conducted. The NHAS is a nationally representative household survey. It's an in-person survey, and for those who may not be familiar with it, it's, like I said, it's conducted in person, and there's a designated, there's a certain core amount of information collected on every family member within the household, and then a sample adult and sample child, and of course our cases we were looking at the sample adult. The sample adult is randomly selected from the household to answer a more comprehensive survey. So our study was limited to the respondents who completed the sample adult survey, and of the 2 years aggregated, it was a little bit over 53,000 respondents. Of those, almost 19,000 were women 40 years of age and older. And again, just as a comparison, a little over 10,000 were women between the ages of 50 and 74. So the questions that were used to determine having a mammogram in the previous 2 years. The women were asked, have you ever had a mammogram? And then were asked, when did you have your most recent mammogram? And the answers were compiled into the following five categories here. And for the purposes of our analysis, we considered a year or less, and more than 1 year, but not more than 2 years ago, as meeting the criteria for having at least a biannual mammogram. We turned to actually a number of questions to help us to answer the question of disability. We've used an algorithm that was first introduced by Altman and Bernstein, 2008, and it breaks down disability into two primary groups: basic actions difficulty, which is composed of movement difficulty, emotional difficulty, vision or hearing, or cognitive difficulty. And then complex activity limitation, which is composed of self-care limitation, work or social limitation. So we obtained an age-adjusted prevalence of mammography for the women by each disability type, as well as for women who did not have any disability or any limitation. We used t-tests to determine statistical significance of the differences. And then we conducted a multivariate analysis, logistic regression, to help us to determine if there was an association between disability and mammography, while we controlled for a number of sociodemographic variables. And I'm going to explain what those were a little further down. We did sort of two types. We looked at any disability or any of the two primary groups as a covariate, and then we looked at the individual disability types as covariates. So overall in the sample, about almost 32% of all the sample adults and 34.6% of all the women reported any limitation. That would be finding or reporting a limitation in any of those groups that I mentioned previously. 45.9% of women 40 and older reported any limitation. Again, that would have been any one of the categories. And in comparison, it was fairly similar to women 50 to 74. The three most frequently occurring types of disability were movement difficulty, work limitation, and visual difficulty. And the first graph I'm showing shows the prevalence of mammography or biannual mammogram prevalence of having a mammogram in the previous 2 years by the overall disability groups. And you can see the women with no limitation, about 70.5% reported having a mammogram in the previous 2 years, compared to women with any limitation was 63.1%. And these groups, the complex activity and basic actions difficulty, they're not mutually exclusive groups, so women can be in more than one group. On this slide, I've just broken out the sort of components of complex activity limitations. You can see what we found the prevalence of having a mammogram in the previous 2 years was. The lowest is women with a noted self-care limitation, about 55.1%. And social and work are fairly similar, about 59%. And then women with any complex activity limitation, 59.7%. Again, in comparison to women with no limitation, still at 70.5%. So a little over 10 percentage point difference. And on this slide, I've just broken out the components of basic actions difficulty. And you can see at the lowest end are women with cognitive difficulty reporting a prevalence of biannual mammogram at 54%. And it goes all the way up to those with movement difficulty at 62.7%. Again, all lower than women with no limitation. And I did want to take a step back. The comparison we did was looking at the women with the particular limitation or difficulty compared to the women without that particular limitation. All the differences were statistically significant at a p-value of less than 0.001, with the exception of hearing, which was significant at a p-value of less than 0.1. So just overall, some overall general findings. When we looked at women with any of the disability or any limitation, we found there was a 7.4 percentage point difference between women with any disability and no disability. We found women that with reported emotional difficulty or a self-care limitation or cognitive difficulty had the lowest reported prevalence of receiving a mammogram in the previous 2 years. And those with vision, hearing, or movement difficulty had the highest reported prevalence of receiving a mammogram in the past 2 years. And again, just as a comparison, we found very similar results in terms of trends when we looked at the smaller age cohort. So when we conducted the logistic regression, we controlled for the following variables in our model: age, race, ethnicity, income, education, employment, marital status, and insurance coverage. And insurance was just a binary yes, no at time of the survey. And these are our results controlling for the covariates, as I mentioned previously. For women with any disability versus no disability and basic actions versus no basic actions, very similar odds ratios, about 0.89. Still significant, but the upper end of the confidence interval is pretty close to one. But definitely lower odds for women with a complex activity limitation. So again, those with self-care or work or social limitation. And these findings are actually very consistent with some other work we've done using a different data set. So we felt really good about this. We found almost very similar odds ratios, in fact, when we used an alternate data set. So we looked at, again, broke out the component parts of each disability group, and we found that for the complex activity limitation components, actually, women with a reported self-care limitation had the lowest odds ratio compared to those without, about 0.72. And when we looked at the basic actions difficulty, and again, the model controls for all of the component parts of the basic actions difficulty, as similar to the other slide, those all were controlled for in the model. We found actually, again, women with a cognitive difficulty consistent with the prevalence also being very low, that women with a cognitive difficulty had fairly low odds, and women also with a vision difficulty. But the other component parts of basic actions difficulty did not have significantly lower odds. So there's certainly a number of limitations to our analysis. The NHIS is a cross-sectional survey, so we can't determine any kind of causality. It also does not include any individuals who are institutionalized, so the prevalence of disability could possibly be underestimated because of that. Additionally, the NHIS data is all based on self-report or the report of a designated family member. We also have limited information of duration, severity, and permanence of disability. And for the purposes of this analysis, we didn't consider the reason for the mammogram. That's something that we can get further into using the NHIS, but just for the purposes of this, we didn't look at that. I'd like to just speak very briefly of the Right to Know. The Right to Know was created in 2008 with CDC, along with partnerships from four state-based disability and health programs. And it's a health promotion, some health promotion materials helping to educate women primarily with physical disabilities or physical mobility limitations on receiving a mammogram, how to address environmental barriers and other barriers that they may encounter when trying to obtain a mammogram. So in conclusion, we found that, consistent with some other research we've done and other research that has been done, is that women with a disability overall are less likely to obtain a mammogram compared to women without a disability. We found that the reported prevalence of receiving a mammogram in the previous 2 years does differ quite a bit by type of disability. And women with cognitive difficulties and self-care limitation had not only the lowest prevalence of receiving a mammogram, but also had the lowest odds ratios of having a mammogram in the previous 2 years. So again, we feel that education intervention programs should really explicitly include women with all types of disabilities, but also really important to keep in mind the differences among type of disability when interventions are designed.
Dr. Kirk, I had a quick question for you. You mentioned in the academic detailing part of your study that the investigators went in, and you provided lunch for everybody, but then you actually had the one-on-one discussions with the providers themselves. Do you have any estimate of what the median age of the people that were actually received sort of the core of the academic detailing, or the average age of those folks?
It was a pretty wide range, actually. We had some very young providers in their mid-30s to early 40s. One of the practices was a very mature practice, and they had a few folks that were in their 50s, and one gentleman who was still practicing in his early 70s. But I would say median age was probably in the mid-40s. So fairly young primary care practice.
And do you have any sense that as the sort of the new generation of practitioners come in, that their affinity for certain types of educational interventions or behavior or practice behavior change, that sort of thing, might change, leaning more towards, instead of the one-on-one facing academic detailing that's really popular, turning more towards social engagement among their peers, maybe using social media or educational gaming simulations, anything like that?
It's a great question, and I don't know how to answer that. Based on the new faculty that we've incorporated into our practices at Penn State, I think they've been trained pretty much traditionally. I don't think we've made that switch, and I think it's something we need to be looking at.
Right on. Thank you very much. That guy.
Hi, Steve Gatlin, NCI. It's a question for, I don't remember your name, it's the Appalachian Project. There was one practice that clearly that had a reduction in or had an increase in screening. I wonder what you knew about that practice and how it might stand out and how the practice itself might be different.
The practice was probably the most rural of the four practices. They were the last of the primary care group in which they were involved to incorporate the electronic medical record. Although they had been using it for several months, that might be part of the issue, is that, first of all, they were the most rural. Number two, they were the last to incorporate the EMR. I think that one of the EMR practices that this primary care network, which spans the New York border south to Harrisburg, which is a pretty large area for a primary care group, they are required to go through the EMR and look for missed screening and preventive health opportunities once a year with each patient. And they were using the EMR actively to manage their population. And this practice was the youngest of the ones using the EMR, so that might have been part of the issue.
Yeah. I have a question for anybody who can answer it. I am on a Komen affiliate board, chair of community profile committee, and I am on a local community mental health authority board, which means serving mentally ill and developmentally disabled. What I'm wondering is whether there are avenues for using the private funding of Komen to reach the disabled, particularly cognitively disabled individuals you were talking about. There's something in what people have said that I can get a handle on and try to take back.
Anyone?
Good question. I don't know if I have a good answer, so how to answer. I think, again, a lot of this work is kind of just the preliminary, and we're starting to look at kind of how, look specifically at this for men and grants among women and looking at type of disability. I think, we're just sort of starting to look at, where the differences lie.
Do you have any information on whether people had coverage? Because some cognitively disabled people will, because of their status, they're going to have a social security program that's giving them coverage. So I wouldn't say, oh, candidate for Komen. I would say, oh, I better make sure the mental health authority is pushing for these kinds of behaviors in our clientele. So it depends on where the person falls on the continuum of cognitive disability. But if you had gathered or you have some way of talking about level of coverage, that would be informative.
Right. And unfortunately for this particular one, the only thing we have in terms of coverage, and this was just used within when we modeled it to control for, and that was just having any type of coverage is determined by the NHIS once the data were cleaned. It's just if they had coverage at the time of the survey, that would just be a yes. Now, I didn't break it down in terms of looking at the prevalence of those with a cognitive difficulty, whether or not they had coverage, but just pulled from the model, unfortunately. But that is something that that probably with the model we could look further at.
I have three questions. One is for Dr. Curry, two are for Dr. White. For Dr. Curry, I'm curious. You said in your result section, you said your screen rate actually increased in like three practice sites. So what kind of method decompose? What kind of method do you use to screen colon cancer increase most? FOBT colonoscopy or black or FIT, do you actually have a chance to examine which tests they use after the intervention? The physician recommend and complete?
I can't answer your question specifically. It's a great question. I can tell you that the majority, 77% of the screenings, both pre and post intervention, was colonoscopy. But I can't tell you if I need to go back and look at that. Thank you for bringing that up. I can't tell you if colonoscopy increased significantly versus FOBT or IFOBT. So, great question. Thank you.
The question for
Dr.
White is,
mm-hmm.
I noticed in your anatomy you use LUCA codes, right?
I'm sorry?
You use LUCA codes. Moodle, Urban.
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So did you find that you can results on the impact of variety on the survival?
It was actually lumped in with SES, so I mean in terms of impacting, causing a decrease in the hazard ratios or it did, I mean it was lumped in with the percentage that were residing in a census tract that was below poverty, so it was all together, so I didn't really separate it out.
When you try to explain to what extent those factors explain the disparity, did you actually check the change of the coefficient or ratio? Is that change significant?
The coefficient for the
for rate for is that significant? The change of the ratio.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Open this up.
I have a question related to the COVID. The last speaker used, and I can think others about this. And this could be a naive question, but when we use income, education, and employment, all three as COVID, are we over controlling? Because there is a lot of overlap in this.
There is. There could be. And these are the covariates that when looking at disability, particularly. Chosen to control for. I think it's a very interesting question, and I initially had actually dropped a couple out and looked at it, but for what I've just reported today, I still included them. But I think that's a very good point. And it, you know, I think as we continue further on with this, we may, particularly with income, I think some of you before, there is still some, there's a lot of missing information in terms of that particular variable, and it may be, I did drop it out to find a whole lot of difference. Not much difference in terms of the overall effect. So I can choose to leave that, but I think it's a good point.
Dr. Orr, do you think that if you diversified or expanded the way that you measure perceived vulnerability and susceptibility, do you think that you would find different outcomes in terms of its significance on health behavior?
Well, I guess if the hypothesis.
I'm sorry, because you. Just measured it by one question?
Asked three questions, but there are three very standard questions that have been developed, probably with white college students. And the ideal situation would be, okay, maybe the issue is not so much the construct itself fundamentally, but how we measure it. And we need to find culturally appropriate ways of tapping into the same idea of perceived susceptibility, vulnerability, worry. So the answer is yes, if we can. It may be a measurement issue, we measure it in culturally appropriate ways, we might find an effect.
Yeah, because I did a study on testicular cancer and TSE in men,
And our factor analysis from our study out of like seven factors that ran, like a third was vulnerability and perceived ability. So, okay, I can talk about that. Thank you.
Another question for Dr. Oram. There's another potential interpretation that happened here from NCI. Perhaps the construct is right. Maybe risk doesn't drive African Americans. Is that also a possibility? Is it that there's another measure which is missing from the model?
Yeah, I think that, so there are some other research that would suggest the fact that maybe risk isn't driving the effect for African Americans, as you mentioned, but rather some different spiritual beliefs, some fatalism beliefs. You know, I haven't measured those, so I don't like to go there. But it has been suggested in the literature that there are some other constructs that are more predictive. But I don't think we should forget this possibility that we're under assessing context, and we're under assessing poverty, racism, et cetera, and that is basically eating up the effect.
No, I think that's an important point, is that there may be other measures, and I agree with you, we need to build those.
Let's diversify.
I have one additional comment. I just completed my dissertation research on this kind of topic. I think we may have met at HINTS in 2009, and I kind of agree with the conversation that's going, and that HINTS doesn't really get at what needs to be brought up as far as African Americans and Hispanics in relation to the mammography. I actually did my research on Generation Y, younger women and their perceptions of even getting a mammogram when they were 40, and I had similar results to yourself.
And that's such an important population to be studying, because we know that African American women on average are likely to get breast cancer earlier than whites. And yet, we often start our studies at age 40 or age 50, leaving out those women. Their perceptions of risk are very important to study.
Yeah, my conclusions were our perceptions count.
Yes.
Any other questions from the group? Come on. Ma'am?
I just had a clarification question from the first speaker. You have used an index score for comorbidities.
Yes.
Could you just tell a little more about it? I may have missed it when you...
Oh, it was, we basically looked at about 18 diagnoses or procedure codes, and we look for those specific procedure codes, and these were assigned a weight. These were assigned a weight.
Oh, so they had different weights?
Yes, according to the degree to which they predicted mortality. And so then those were summed to produce an index score. So it's basically the Charlson comorbidity score, a modified version of the Charlson comorbidity score.
Any other questions?
Just to clarify, so it's context, not content. So the content's there, risk is very important, but it's the way that we're asking this, we're measuring this. That's the thing that we're trying to get at?
I think we have two competing hypotheses and not enough data to speak to either one. It could be measurement, it could be that the construct itself is not culturally resonating. So...
content, now we're asking.
Yeah.
Okay.
Got it. We need to...
without feeding it in the ground, the third option is that it's measured correctly, and that there are other things that are more important that we need to be measuring. So that, I think it's a real fundamental issue. Do we spend more time trying to refine the measure of risk, or do we start asking broader questions and build better models with the take other factors into account? And that's a really critical question. I don't know if you can answer it.
Fabulous. Very much for attending this session of the Cancer Forum.